I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 221. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight and NumberFire.com. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, I've got a great guest. I haven't talked to him since very early in the season. Scott Lauber, Philly's beat writer for Philly.com, is going to join us in just a couple of minutes. He had a great piece on Scott Kingery that we're going to talk about his struggles here in 2018. We're also going to talk about the Phillies' payroll, the likelihood of Manny Machado and Bryce Harper coming to Philadelphia this offseason, and they're going to lay out the offseason. We're going to lay it out as a whole here coming up in just a few minutes. Also, I'm going to give you my five favorite things from the 2018 Philly season, as well as my five least favorite things from the season. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But again, just a reminder, folks, to make sure you subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed, everybody. That way you will get every episode of Hittin' Season, every episode of Continued Success, every episode of The Dirty Inning, and any special bonus podcasts that we throw your way. Also, we have some very special podcasts for Patreon subscribers to Hittin' Season. I'm doing a podcast called This Week in Philly's History. I'm doing some previews for all the playoff series, and we'll be continuing that throughout the offseason. Justin will be doing some special The Dirty Inning podcasts, and we'll be doing some special Continued Success podcasts also for members who sign up at a certain tier. So go to patreon.com/hittinseason and make sure you check that out as well. All right, now here, but what I want to start off the podcast with this week is obviously we are all geared towards the off season, and you know if you're looking for some playoff stuff, I'm going to have a preview for the National League and American League Championship Series on the Patreon. So again, go to patreon.com/hittinseason. I'm going to break down both of the League Championship Series for you there. But I want to spend most of the time on this podcast, on episode 221, talking about this offseason because this is going to be a monstrously important offseason. We all know it. We all know how important it is for the Phillies to get this right this offseason, for things to go right this offseason. And so what I want to do is I'm not going to pretend to try and be Matt Klintak because there are so many moving pieces here, but I want to give you the three moves that I would make if I were Matt Klintak this winter. The three moves that I would make, and there's a plan A and a plan B with all this, how all this is shaking out, because the Phillies are really going to need to go and get their superstars from other places. The Phillies don't have that young stud superstar like the Astros had with Jose Altuve and Carlos Correa and Alec Bregman and, you know, all those different guys that they had. They had all this great young homegrown talent that they could choose from, that they could build around. The Cubs had Chris Bryant and Kyle Schwarber and Javier Baez and all these different guys. Those guys are just not here in Philadelphia. We don't have that. And so what the Phillies are going to have to do is they're going to have to use the Milwaukee Brewers model. They're going to have to go out and get a Christian Yelich and a Lorenzo Cain. And, you know, they're going to have to go out and find their star players in other ways. Maybe Rhys Hoskins turns into that star player. Maybe he turns into one of those type of guys. To me, he's still a little uneven, you know, and he hasn't really gotten to that level yet. But I think he could get there sometime, but in the meantime, they need to go out and they need to get Bryce Harper or Manny Machado. They really need to get one of those two guys this offseason. And so here are the three moves that I would make if I were Matt Klintak this winter. And this is with the full understanding that what I'm about to say is easier said than done. I know it's not as easy as simply, you know, going to Target and picking Bryce Harper up off a shelf and going and grabbing this guy off the shelf and maybe going into the back room and bartering with the Target officials for somebody else. I understand it's not that easy, but for the sake of a podcast, for the sake of having fun, these are my three things. First, sign Manny Machado. To me, he is the most, and this is plan A. I have a plan A where the Phillies sign Machado and a plan B where they sign Bryce Harper. Because if you sign one of those two different guys, the other moves, some of the other moves that you make are going to be different because each one of those guys fills in a different hole. So if you sign Manny Machado, here's what I would do if I were Matt Klentak. If you get Manny Machado, you've got shortstop handled. And then you can figure out third base and everything else. I think you need to sign an outfielder. I think you need to get another bat for the outfield. And there's a lot of different options. You could trade for David Peralta from Arizona. That would be a fine move. You could go out and you could sign A.J. Pollock. A.J. Pollock is a guy who doesn't have a real big bat anymore, but is a very good defender and can play an above-average defensive center field. So if you want to improve the defense, you could go out and get A.J. Pollock to play center field. The move that I would make is I would go out and I would try to sign Michael Brantley to play a corner outfield spot, to play left field. He's 32. He's been injured a lot over the last couple of years, but he stayed healthy for the entire 2018 season. And he brings a bat that the Phillies don't have, a .309 batting average, .364 on base, .468 slugging this year, 17 home runs, 12 steals, and a 3.5 Fangraphs wins above replacement. He's not great defensively, but he's not Rhys Hoskins out in left field. He can man the position ably. He's not gonna be a guy that covers a ton of ground out there, so he's not gonna be a gold glover. You're getting him for his bat. But if you're getting Machado to help your defense improve on the infield, you can still have Roman Quinn as one of your outfielders, and you can still have Nick Williams in the outfield, and you could even still have Odubel Herrera factored into the outfield mix in some way. But I go get Michael Brantley. He would be the free agent outfielder that I would want them to target if they get Machado. And then I want them to go trade for... Well, let me get to that in just a second. If you sign Harper, then the free agent offensive player I would want the Phillies to go after is Marwin Gonzalez, because I still think you would need to get somebody for the left side of your infield. Now, Marwin Gonzalez had an amazing 2017 season for the Astros during that World Series run. He had a .907 OPS, 23 home runs, 34 doubles. He plays everywhere on the diamond, literally. He is Ben Zobrist. Now, he had a down offensive year, and maybe 2017 ends up being his career season, and he never gets up to that level again. But, you know, I certainly think that he is a guy who can get to 750, 770 OPS. Maybe he can get you to 800 OPS. He would fit what the Phillies want, a guy who can play everywhere, but he can play third base and shortstop for you. He can play all over. He can play the outfield too. He had a .733 OPS this year with 16 homers, 25 doubles, and a 2.5 wins above replacement, down from 4.3 the season before. But I think he brings enough to the table. He would be the best infield option. And we heard Andy McPhail talking about the phenomenal free agent class after the 2019 season. Marwin Gonzalez is a guy that if Nolan Arenado happens to be available, if Anthony Rendon happens to be available, you could move Marwin Gonzalez to an outfield spot. Okay? And then you could sign one of those third basemen. He gives you that flexibility, so that if you needed to wait for another offseason to get your infield long-term solution, you could do that. So that's why I would go with Marwin Gonzalez, and I don't think he'd cost a lot either. Marwin Gonzalez, he wouldn't be cheap, but he would be less expensive than Michael Brantley probably, and less expensive than some of the other outfield possibilities, I would imagine. So I think you go Machado, Michael Brantley, and that's probably the more expensive of the two options, or you go Harper, Gonzalez. Those would be my two options here. I also think the Phillies are not going to be able to just get everything through free agency. I think they're going to be adding things through trade, and I think you go, if the Phillies are going to add a starting pitcher, which I think they probably should do, I think you pursue that through trade, because I'm not enamored with the free agent options. Yes, if Clayton Kershaw decides to opt out of his deal with the Dodgers, which he could, that could happen, then I would be open to that. I would certainly be open to that. I'm not as enamored with Dallas Keuchel. The Phillies definitely need a left-hander for the rotation. I'm just not enamored with Dallas Keuchel. He relies too much on ground balls. He relies too much on contact. And unless the Phillies are able to shore up that defense, and I don't know how you can do both, get a better offense and a better defense, I don't think this is the best place for Dallas Keuchel. Dallas Keuchel needs a good defense behind him. And even if the Phillies make some upgrades in some places, they're not going to have a top 10 defense next year. Jay Happ is a guy I think would be a good cheap free agent option. I think that would be an option where, you know, if you wanted to get something for the middle of the rotation, you could do it that way. But the guy that I would want to see the Phillies try and make an offer for is Madison Bumgarner, who's entering the last year of his deal with the Giants. The Giants are struggling. They have a new general manager. I think you could be looking at rebuild mode for San Francisco. And if that's the case, why wouldn't they try to deal Madison Bumgarner this offseason? This would be the time. If they're going to trade Madison Bumgarner instead of just letting him walk in free agency, this offseason, this winter is the time to deal Madison Bumgarner. And I don't think the Phillies are going to get Patrick Corbin. I think Corbin is signed, sealed, and delivered to the Yankees. I think that's a pipe dream. I don't think that's happening. But I think that Madison Bumgarner will be available. And I don't know if the Phillies have the pieces, but it would be a one-year rental, so it might not cost an arm and a leg. You might have to give up Adonis Medina to go get Madison Bumgarner. Is that a deal that you make if you've gotten Machado or Harper, if you've signaled that you want to make a postseason run this year? I think it is, because if you don't have to deal Sixto Sanchez, which I wrote about for the Good Fight this week, by the way, that the Phillies should be at least more open to the possibility of dealing Sixto Sanchez given his setback. It's not a major setback. The Phillies insist that he'll be fine, but if you want to at least kind of keep those options open, I wouldn't include Sixto Sanchez in a Madison Bumgarner deal, but I would consider Adonis Medina. And maybe that's a little expensive for some people, but you know, I think you have to give a little to get a little. And that would be a trade target that I would absolutely go after. The other final piece, that'd be my second move, would be trading for Madison Bumgarner. So the first move, Machado and Brantley or Harper and Gonzalez. Move number two, Madison Bumgarner. And move number three, sign Bud Norris. Not to be your closer. I think he was miscast as the Cardinals' closer last year. He shouldn't face right-handed pitching. But against lefties, he's very, very good. He had a 2.43 ERA also away from St. Louis last year, which is a little bit weird because St. Louis is a pretty good pitcher's park. But against left-handers, they hit just 180 against him with a 269 on base and a 289 slugging percentage. And he gave up 0.55 home runs per nine innings against left-handed hitters last year. That's your lefty specialist, kids. And the Phillies need one. The Phillies need a left-hander. And I don't think Bud Norris would cost a whole lot. You'd probably only have to sign him to a two-year deal. That's my move, signing Bud Norris. That's the bullpen move I'm making. Because if you're signing Machado and Brantley, or if you're signing Harper and Gonzalez, and you're taking on Bumgarner's $12 million contract, you can't afford Zach Britton. You can't afford Craig Kimbrell. You know, I don't think you can afford those guys. So you getting a left-handed reliever would be important. I'm going after Bud Norris. Those are the moves that I'm making if I'm Matt Klintak. That's what I'm trying to do. That's a lot. And again, I know that's easier said than done. I don't necessarily expect Matt Klintak to be able to do all that. But I think that's the quantity of moves that I'm expecting from the Phillies this offseason. I think those are the holes that need to be filled. I think you need to get two hitters. I think you need to find a way to bring another starting pitcher in here. And I think you need to find a way to bring a left-handed reliever in here. I think they have to figure out a way to do all of those different things. And those would be the moves that I would make, at least that I would try to make, if I were general manager Matt Klintak.
This ball is out of here!
Well, obviously, we're going to be spending the next few episodes, probably the next few months, talking about what this offseason has in store for the Phillies. And, you know, one of the things that we heard during the Andy McPhail press conference and one of the things that we have heard a lot about is the Phillies' payroll flexibility. They got a lot of payroll. They can spend it on as many players as they want. Well, is that really true? How much payroll flexibility are we talking about here? And Scott Lauber, who's a Phillies beat writer for Philly.com, had a very good piece about what the payroll's looking like here coming up this offseason. Exactly how much money do the Phillies have? Scott put pen to paper and actually kind of figured out exactly what we're looking at, and he's joining us on Hittin' Season once again. Scott, thanks for coming back on the podcast. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to this offseason, man. I think this could be maybe even more exciting than the season we just had, because obviously we're all expecting the Phillies to do some big things this winter. We've been kind of promised it almost, and I know Andy McPhail tried to kind of temper those expectations a little bit during his end of year news conference, but between you and me, I'm not buying a lot of that. I think John Middleton really kind of wants to get back in the game, and this team we saw had a good season for the most part until the last 6 weeks. So it feels like now's the time. Now they're in a position in which they can kind of strike, take advantage of a very interesting set of free agents. I think they're going to be an active team on the trade market as well, because they've got a big logjam on the roster here. But before we can even know what it is the Phillies might go after player-wise, it's kind of important to know what kind of money they have to go shopping with. I mean, you don't go to the grocery store without knowing, well, at least you shouldn't go to the grocery store without knowing how much money you have to spend. So what are we talking about here in terms of payroll flexibility for this team this offseason?
Yeah, you know, so when I look at it, I look at the offseason that's coming up, and I think, you know, they're going to do a lot of things. And within that, a lot of things, you would imagine they're going to do a few big things. I expected that there'd be a lot of change, even when they were playing pretty well. You know, maybe in sort of mid-August, when the slide was when the collapse was merely a slide. You know, I was sort of thinking like, well, even if they, you know, somehow win the division or sneak into the playoffs, you know, as the second wild card, it could be one of those things where you sort of see a lot of changes. And then, of course, it turns into a collapse, and you're like, well, now there are going to be sweeping changes. And I do expect a lot of changes, and I do expect some big ones. And I kind of agree with you that what Andy McPhail was doing at his end-of-season press conference was, in fact, tempering expectations. Because for all that we've talked about and written about Bryce Harper and Manny Machado, it's not like the Phillies are going – after these guys in a vacuum. There are going to be other teams that are interested in those players, and quite possibly those two players will be interested in going places other than Philadelphia.
Right.
So it's not out of the realm to think that they could swing and miss on both. And I think that's a little bit of what Andy McPhail was doing. Now, he wasn't saying, you know, I don't think he was trying to say, look, we're going to punt on those two players. I think he was trying to say, this is not the end-all, be-all. And
right.
Honestly, that's sort of the spin I'd put on it, too, if I were in his shoes. I think if they come up empty on both of those guys, it's a tremendously failed offseason, and they're going to have to do a lot of spin. And I think this was sort of like just kind of like preparing for, you know, all that talk about, oh, next year's free agent class is really good.
Right.
That's true, except what if Nolan Arenado signs an extension, or Paul Goldschmidt signs an extension, or, you know, what if that class, you know, 6 months from now or 8 months from now, or certainly 12 months from now, looks a lot different than it did. So I don't really look at it that way. I you know, and then, you know, he did sort of challenge the idea put forth, I think, by John Heyman, but also propagated by some people, officials from other teams that I've spoken to throughout the course of the year, who are talking about, well, they've got all this money to spend, and maybe they could get them both, Harper and Machado.
And that's the dream.
And win the offseason.
Yeah.
That is the dream. And Andy sort of, I think, was sort of saying, you know, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because think about it, you know, I don't really know that we have that much money. So I thought about, all right, well, he said, you know, someone didn't put pen to paper, so I thought, all right, let's do that. And kind of broke it down a little bit. And so basically, you know, there are six guys who are under contract for next season, guaranteed contracts for next season. It's Arrieta, Santana, Neshek, Hunter, Odubel Herrera, and Scott Kingery. Now, if you bring all those guys back, that's $69 million right there, almost $69 million right there, tied up in those six players. There are, I believe, 12 arbitration-eligible players, and if you go by the projections that MLB Trade Rumors does, which are typically pretty close to what it ends up being, it's like 37 and change, $37 million and change for those 12 players. That's if they if they brought them all back. Now, of course, they're not going to bring them all back, but for argument's sake, let's say they did. So that brings your number to, you know, like, what, 106?
Yeah.
Then there are a bunch of guys, Rhys Hoskins, Sir Anthony Dominguez, who are pre-arb eligible. So they're going to make anywhere from $500,000 to, you know, the upper end of that. You know, look, if they really want to, you know, if they really want to be good to someone like Hoskins, it's going to be like 800, 900. And that would be really good for somebody at his experience level. So, you know, it's not pocket change, but it doesn't really add up that much. So let's say, you know, let's say it's rounding off. Let's say it's like 107, 108 million if you brought everybody back.
Right.
And if you're going to take Andy McPhail at his word and say, well, eventually they're going to get up to where their payroll once was, you know, I don't think that's going to happen in 1 year. You know, I think they topped out in 2014 at like $178 million. So, you know, I just sort of, to be, I know it's completely and totally arbitrary, but to just say, well, listen, they'll gradually get to that point. I don't see it happening in a year. Let's say for argument's sake, they spend 140 or 150. So that leaves you with, you know, $40 or $50 million to play with. And you can probably get one of the two big guys plus some other pieces for that kind of money. And we all know that ultimately they're going to have way more than $40 or $50 million to spend because they're not bringing everybody back.
Right.
So, you know, I looked at it and I said, well, you know, they certainly have enough to get one of the two. Do they have enough to get both? I don't know. I don't think it's totally far-fetched, but look, I don't think anyone should bank on that happening. I think that the point I was trying to make was in the piece was that they have enough to get one plus, and mm-hmm. plus meaning a pretty good starting pitcher if they want to go that route, another hitter, because I think we all agree they're more than one hitter short
yep.
of being a really good offense. So they're going to have flexibility. They're going to have money to spend. And, you know, I think, again, it goes back to what we said off the top, which is that I really think that McPhail was sort of lowering some expectations. He was trying to cushion things in case the offseason doesn't go as gangbusters as we all, you know, think it might or as the fans want it to. So I think that that's really what that was about. I think that at the end of the day, if they want to spend, and, you know, you keep hearing from officials from other teams, you know, Middleton's ready to spend. He's just itching to spend. He's going to hand, you know, whichever free agent they prefer a blank check and say, write your number down. If he is every bit as itchy to spend as people think he is,
yeah.
they're going to have the money to spend.
Yeah, and if Middleton does that, if he basically says, here, whatever you want, Bryce, whatever you want, Manny, and they choose to go someplace else, then, you know, what can you do? You can swing and you miss, but you can take a hell of a cut, and I think that's what we're obviously going to see them try to do that. And do you get the sense that they still prefer one or the other? Do you get the sense that they prefer Machado over Harper, that Machado would be a better fit, or is it one or the other for them?
I don't know, and it's a fascinating question, and I did a piece toward the end of the season where I spoke to some different scouts and executives from other teams about, look, if everything was equal and the money was the same and you had a need at either position, infield, left side infield, or in the outfield, you know, if as the Phillies do,
yeah.
you know, if the money was equal and the need was equal, which guy would you get? And honestly, like, I got pretty much a split decision. A lot of people said Machado, citing his defense as kind of the separator between him and Harper. The fact that at third base, he's elite. At shortstop, he's pretty good. Ultimately, before the end of the contract, he'll be a third baseman. So, you know, I know he prefers shortstop now, but a lot of people are looking at him and saying he's going to move back to third at some point where he is gold glove caliber.
Right.
But a lot of people looked at Harper and said his bat might be more of an impact bat. And, you know, maybe he's a little bit more of a leader type than Machado is. I don't know that that's totally true, but that's certainly one of the perceptions out there. So it was really kind of a split. And if you'd asked me this, if we were talking about this in July, I probably would have told you Machado was their preference simply because we know how much so many of the higher-ups, from McPhail to Klentak to Ned Rice to of course, now the departed Joe Jordan.
Yeah.
You know, we know how much all of them had had contact with Manny early in his career, had to do with bringing him to Baltimore, especially Joe Jordan. I would have told you that they were head over heels for Machado, and they might still be. But, you know, then you hear things late in the season, you know, it really kind of raised my antenna when, after the last game the Phillies played against the Nats, Gabe Kapler referred to Harper as maybe the best player in baseball. And, you know,
yeah.
He wasn't even asked about Bryce Harper.
I remember that.
He just brought that up. So yeah. I was like, oh, file that away. You know, if that tells you what the manager thinks, then, and the manager has, this particular manager, I believe, has a lot to say about what they're going to do. So file that away. And maybe Harper, you start thinking about it, maybe he fits the offensive profile. Guy who sees a lot of pitches, draws a lot of walks, gets on base, maybe not the highest batting average, but hits a ton of home runs. You know, you could see him batting in a number of spots in the lineup where, you know, 1 through 4. You know, so you start to think, well, maybe he's the guy. So I don't really know, as we sit here on, the second week of October, which one they really do prefer. I don't think it's a coin flip. I don't think that they're going to go in to the offseason saying, well, you know, we'll take either or. I think that they're probably going to have a preference and go after the guy they prefer and go after the other one as sort of a fallback. But, and I think they'll be aggressive on both. Don't get me wrong. But I think that ultimately when they get right to it and they start to sift through how much do they want to offer and whatnot, they're going to prefer one over the other. I just don't know at this point which one it's going to be.
I want to run by you. I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, but I want to run by you the three moves I'd make if I were Matt Klentak this winter. And let me know what you think of these, because I think you have to have a plan A, plan B. One if you sign Machado and one if you sign Harper, because your needs are different at other positions if you sign one guy or the other. So my thinking is, if you sign Machado, I think, like you said, you still need to get another bat. I would love to see them go after Michael Brantley, the outfielder for Cleveland. Had a pretty good season. And I would love to see them try and see what the Giants' asking price is on Madison Bumgarner. I think Bumgarner I think he's going to be dealt this winter, because the Giants aren't competing for anything next year. He'll be a free agent at the end of next season. Maybe they hold off until the trade deadline thinking they can get, but I think you get more in the winter when you have all 30 teams potentially vying for Bumgarner in the final year of his deal. And then I signed Bud Norris because they desperately need a left-handed relief pitcher. And they're not going to, if they go out and they get Machado or Harper, I don't know that they have the money to sign a Zach Britton along with one of those two other guys. So that's my plan if they get Machado. My plan if they get Harper is still to trade for Bumgarner, sign Bud Norris, and maybe sign Marwin Gonzalez to play the left side of the infield. And he's a guy who Gabe Kapler would fall in love with, because he literally does play every single position on the diamond. And he slid offensively a little bit this season, for sure, but I still think he's a guy that would be very useful in this particular environment. What do you think?
It's interesting. Bumgarner is a really interesting one. And the one thing I'll say is it doesn't seem like it's ever the Giants' MO to completely and totally rebuild. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're one of those teams that always sort of feels like they're a move or two away in the offseason from being a contender again. So if they were to trade Bumgarner, I think it would be a signal, right, that they were going to go through a bit of a rebuild. And again, I think, you know, maybe they will. I guess it depends on, you know, who they hire as their new general manager and what his vision is for where the Giants are headed. It's difficult to sort of gauge. When I say that they're one of those teams that never sort of rebuilds, that was under Bobby Evans Fabian. And so, you know, depending on who they bring in, they may go a different direction. But just knowing how the Giants operate, it just doesn't feel to me like training Bumgarner is the typical move they make. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see whether he ends up being one of those guys who's on the block. I think you're right on, though, about the fact that it's not going to be all free agency.
Yeah.
You know, if you read between the lines again to a lot of what both Klentak and McPhail were saying last week. You know, they were talking about their free agent class from last year, and I think Klentak was the first of the two to make the point that, you know, they got, I believe he said it was the fourth most production by WAR out of their free agent class.
And right.
That sounds great when you think about, you know, just on the surface, until you consider that they spent the second most in
right.
free agency. And
right.
so, you know, McPhail sort of sounded a bit of a different tone and said, yeah, well, we got the fourth most production, but we spent the second most. That's not a real good return on your investment. And I think he's right. And I think it just sort of goes to show that free agency is sort of a dangerous business or dangerous way to go about building your team. I don't think they want to kind of dive fully into that yet. Harper Machado is certainly different animal, given their age, the fact that they're both 26, and if they get 10-year deals, so they'll be in their mid-30s by the end of those deals. Those deals really, you know, unless they wind up being something absurd like 12 or 13-year deals,
right.
those deals by the end of them should not look like the Albert Pujols deal looks now or the
right.
Miguel Cabrera deal looks now. Those should be more, you know, I don't want to say they don't come with risk because they come with huge risk, but age-wise, I don't think you have to worry as much about how that player is going to look in 10 years because they're still going to be, you know, they'll be in their mid-30s. They're not going to be broken down and done. And so, you know, I think they're different. But, you know, now you start getting into buying pitchers or buying other players, and I don't think they want to do that. So I think you're spot on that there are going to be some trades here, and there are quite a few pieces that they have that they could entertain moving. I don't know how much value you're going to get at this point for Cesar Hernandez, probably certainly less than you would have gotten last offseason if you traded him.
Yeah.
I don't know how much value you're going to get for Michael Franco or, you know, Odubel Herrera, but those are going to be guys who I'm sure they're going to be listening to quite a bit, listening to offers on guys like that. And
yeah.
maybe you're able to get some pieces or fill some needs that way. Bumgarner is kind of a, you know, you're shooting high there, right? I mean, you're shooting for a number one. I don't know that they need to shoot that high in their rotation. I think that they can look for, you know, a high-end, middle-of-the-rotation kind of guy. By that, I mean a 2-3, kind
sure.
of that sort of thing. And maybe that's something that you can get in a trade for pieces that you've got. So, you know, we talk about the free agents who are out there, and that's going to be fascinating in and of itself, but what they do in the trade market is going to be just as intriguing, and we can't really project yet who's even going to be available. You sort of start to think about, you know, all right, who are guys who are going to be free agents a year or two from now?
Mm-hmm.
Who are guys who are really reaching that phase in arbitration where they're really making a lot of money and maybe they play for a smaller market team that's not going to be able to afford them anymore? And you can just sit there all day and pore over rosters and you really don't know yet. So the trade market really hasn't developed, you know, quite as much. And it's just going to be interesting as we get to the GM meetings at the start of November and these teams start to talk, who's really going to be out there for them? Because I think they're going to fill a need through a trade and other needs through free agency. And it'll just be fascinating to see how it all shapes up.
Yeah, last year you could see a couple of the deals coming from a mile away because you knew the Marlins were going to enter a fire sale. So you knew that Giancarlo Stanton was going to get dealt. You knew that Christian Yelich was going to get dealt. There was a couple other trades you could really see coming. But, you know, I don't know that there's a team that you can identify that will go into full-on tank mode this winter necessarily, at least at this point. You're right, it needs to kind of be sussed out. The free agents, you know who's available. You know who's there. It's real easy to kind of go through that list. But, yeah, I agree with you. If it's not Madison Bumgarner, I think bringing in some people through trades as also a way to kind of, you know, clear out the brush from the 25-man roster is also something that needs to be done. There needs to be a little bit more clarity, I think, on this roster, who's going to be here long term. And one of the guys that we know, I think, is going to be here long term. Last thing I wanted to talk to you about, it was your excellent piece on Scott Kingery and trying to identify what went wrong with him this year. And, you know, it's really a shame. I was talking about it on the last podcast with my colleague, Liz Rocher, who, you know, we're both talking about the fact that, you know, it's so sad that Kingery, who came into this season as somebody we were really excited about, this prospect who we thought had a bright future, he did great in the minors last year. He once again, for the second spring in a row, really, was looking like one of the best players in camp, and they sign him to the deal, they bring him up, and he actually, people forget, he had a very good first month of the season. You know, first few weeks of the season, he was one of their better players. He was coming through, hitting, getting big doubles. I think he had like 7 doubles in the first 3 weeks of the season or something like that. And then it just went away. It just completely went away. And I know you talked to him and you talked to John Mailey about his struggles this year. What were some of the things that you found out about Kingery and his struggles in 2018? What happened there?
Well, you know, the way this started was the day, the season, the last day, the last game, I went over to him after the game, and he was at his locker like a lot of the guys were that day, and he was sort of packing a few things up. And I went over to him and asked him if he had a few minutes. And you know, he was pretty available throughout the course of the year. You know, wasn't one of those guys who was difficult to find, and a lot like Hoskins, was very accountable for a lot of the things that went on. But I just found him to be kind of, it looked like the weight of the world had been lifted off his shoulders.
you know,
he looked relieved that it was all over. He looked like someone who desperately needs a break from baseball for a few weeks. And yeah. So he started talking, and, you know, I started asking him about his season, and, you know, he kind of opened up a little bit more, I felt like, than he had, at least with me, and I think with most of us who were in that room, you know, where he was talking about, quite honestly, I really don't know what happened. I don't know what that was all about, you know. It was sort of like him going, I don't know what the heck that was the last 5 months, and we kind of went through it, and it was sort of very clear to me that whatever it was, and look, I think if you go back to April, and you're right, you know, when I got here the second or third week of the season, and he was a guy, I think he was batting third when I got here, I kind of looked at that a little cross-eyed and thought, all right, I get it. He had a great spring, and he's had a good few weeks, but he's still a rookie who had half a season at AAA. Shouldn't this guy be batting ninth? You know, but obviously it spoke to how well he was doing at the plate and how good he looked. And, you know, what I interpreted it as when it started to go south was, okay, you know, the book is out on him. There's more detailed scouting report. I remember having a conversation with him in Washington at the end of April, early May. And it was sort of like he was saying, like, the ironic thing is the longer I'm in the big leagues, the harder it gets because, you know, like the more video they have on me, the more ways they have to attack me. You know, it should get easier, right? In theory, the longer you're in the league, it actually gets harder because they have a more thorough report on you. So, you know, I took that as, okay, the guy's going through the league now a second time and they're adjusting to him and he'll have to adjust back. And the deeper it got and the worse it got, the more he tried to fix it and the worse it got. So he'd go in the cage and I think he was trying to do some things that, you know, he's tinkering with his swing and he was, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of voices in his head, about, you know, what he should do, his approach at the plate, what that should be. Let's not forget the Phillies had a new hitting coach this year, and John Mailey brought in a lot of his own philosophies that were not anything that the guys in the minor leagues were accustomed to. So, you know, I'm sure that there were a lot of voices filling his head, and it just got deeper and deeper and deeper, and he just drowned, you know. And so that's kind of what this piece sort of generated from, was this conversation with him, where he was saying, you know, look, he acknowledged that he probably put pressure on himself because, let's face it, he came out of spring training. He was the flavor of the month. He just signed this big contract. You know, the Phillies had obviously made it very clear that he was a big part of their future. And now it's like, oh, crap, now I have to justify it. So, you know, and as the slump got worse, I'm sure the pressure got greater and greater. So, I'm sure it wasn't easy, the fact that the first 6 weeks of the season he was playing a different position every night. You know, they downplayed that at the time, but even Kingery said, I remember when he was going through it, that it's not, you know, he's focused on 3 hours before the game, he's taking fly balls in right field, and maybe he'd be better served watching some video or being in the cage a little longer. So there was a lot that went on with him this year, and you just hope that, you know, a few weeks away to clear his head, whatever sort of work he wants to do this offseason, you just sort of hope that it's not, all is not lost with somebody like him, because, you know, because obviously there's the potential there. And, you know, they sort of feel like going through the league once, it'll relax him, it'll make him a little bit more, he'll know more what to expect when he comes back next year. But, you know, you wonder how much damage was done off a season like this. You know, he got 450-plus plate appearances and was, like, I think in just about every category, like the second or third worst hitter in the league, in the major.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the worst hitter in the National League. So it was a difficult year to go through, it just struck me the last day of the season how unbelievably relieved he looked that it was all over, that he was going to get to go home, that he was going to get to sort of be away from the game for a few weeks, and that, you know, maybe, you know, it was like, maybe I'll wake up and you know, in the middle of October and I'll forget it ever happened, and I can just go on and be the player that I, you know, I've always been. So, you know, that's sort of where it came from, and I really thought he was pretty candid that day about everything he'd gone through and the struggles he'd gone through, and just how confusing it was to him as much as it was to everyone who was watching and saying, you know, I can't imagine that this is the same guy. He felt the same way.
Yeah, well, it is kind of a relief to hear that. I mean, and there are some things, obviously, you look at the numbers break it down a little bit. You know, I think you ran the numbers that he fell behind. You know, your eyes told you that he was falling behind every count, and the numbers bear it out. Fell behind 0-2 in, what was it, 153 of his 484 plate appearances, the highest percentage of anybody in the majors. But when he would swing at the first pitch, 31 times he did that, he went 13 for 29 with three doubles and slugged 552. I mean, those are some of the adjustments. Maybe they can look back at the numbers, and you mentioned in the piece, John Manley, talking about being selective but being aggressive. And that's the thing, is the whole idea for a hitter is to get yourself into a count, get yourself into a position where you're going to get the pitch you're looking for in the spot that you want. And it seemed like he was maybe moving over too far to the side of being selective, Scott.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, the thing I heard when I came over here that was being talked about a lot during spring training was, you know, this idea of grinding out at-bats, long at-bats, make the pitcher work. And I covered the Red Sox, right? I mean, that was their MO for years and years and years. That's where Gabe Kapler got it from. And you know, Manley, when you talk to John Manley, he frames it differently. For him, it's not so much grinding out a long at bat or working a pitcher's pitch count. It's the way he frames it is, he's like, look, I don't tell anyone to take early in a count or whatever. I just say, look, you know, hitting was never my thing. This is why I write about it and I don't do it. But, like, it sounds overly simplified to me, is that, you know, look for your pitch, wait for your pitch, and then attack it. So, okay, fine. Like, if I'm Scott Kingery and I'm hearing grind out at-bats, work a pitch count, and then I'm hearing the hitting coach say, don't swing until you get your pitch in your zone, and I'm in my first year in the big leagues, and I'm used to letting a fastball go in the minor leagues and knowing I'm going to get another one probably in my zone later in the at-bat. It doesn't happen in the big leagues. And so if I'm Kingery, I'm maybe being a little bit too selective early in the count and getting myself in a hole that I can't get out of. And that seems like that's what happened. And, you know, in talking to John Manley, I said, well, you know, I've heard you guys talk about this selective aggressive thing a lot. And it sounds great, except what if, you know, what if you've got a hitter who's just not able to recognize early enough in the count that he missed his pitch?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, they think that that's something that they can work with a guy on. And maybe Kingery learned that. Maybe he learned that, look, if I think that there's something that I can drive or, you know, do damage with early in a count, there's no shame in swinging at it. Yeah. Why wait? Because I'm not going to get that pitch in that location again. And maybe he learned that. You know, I think it was probably easy for him, too, to look at Carlos Santana and Cesar Hernandez and these guys who were working these long at-bats and drawing all these walks and having him go, well, this is the hitter they want me to be. Well, not necessarily. You know, if you get your pitch and it's the first pitch, go after it. And hopefully he learned that lesson. And next year he's not going to go try to be Carlos Santana. He's going to go try to be who he is and drive a pitch where he can do the most damage.
Yeah, just be comfortable, man. Do what you got to do to make yourself comfortable at the plate. I mean, Javi Baez had an MVP season doing what he does, which is completely different than anything what the Cubs really wanted him to do. But, you know, sometimes a young player's got to find his own way. It was a really good piece on Scott Kingery. I really enjoyed it. And, Scott, it was a long time between coming on the podcast, but I hope to have you on again during the offseason here if you've got the time. I really appreciated your time.
Absolutely, anytime.
This ball is out of here.
All right, real quick before we get out of here, I thought this might be fun. I came up with a list of my five favorite things from the 2018 Philly season, and then I also came up with a list of my five least favorite things from the 2018 season. And during the course of the next few weeks, we at The Good Fight, we're going to start to be doing some player reviews. I'm going to have something out on Odubel Herrera either on Friday or at the beginning of next week. But all of us are going to start to be going through the roster and looking back at 2018 just a little bit to wrap things up, put a bow on certain players, certain positions, because that'll help clarify where the needs are moving forward here in the offseason. But as far as my five favorite things from the 2018 Phillies season, some of these things will get fleshed out a little bit more in some of those pieces. But my number one favorite thing from the 2018 season is obviously Aaron Nola's emergence as a top three starter in the National League, as a legitimate Cy Young candidate. His emergence as a true ace was the number one joy for all Phillies fans here during the 2018 season. My second favorite thing about 2018 was being in first place at the All-Star break. There's something special at baseball's unofficial midway point to be in first place. And this year the Phillies were. The Phillies were in first place at the All-Star break. You got for 4 days to see the Phillies atop the National League East standings when the entire baseball world comes together for the Midsummer Classic. I thought that was very cool. That's always a big benchmark to me. We've seen other Phillies teams, it was only by one game, by the way, and I know that. And we've seen other Phillies teams be in first place at the All-Star break and for it all to fall apart. And that happens. And that happened again in 2018. But that I thought that at the moment, that was very cool for me to see. That was always a cool benchmark for me. Number three, the Phillies were buyers at the trade deadline. For the first time in forever, the Phillies were buyers at the trade deadline. We weren't looking to sell. We weren't looking to try and, you know, to deal some aging veteran like Pat Nashak for crumbs. You know, we weren't trying to find some guy we thought maybe could be a decent middle of the bullpen guy 2 years from now. We were buying. Now, some of those acquisitions didn't work out. Jose Bautista is actually the one who probably worked out the best. But as Drubal Cabrera did not work out. Justin Bour did not work out. And that's unfortunate. Aaron Loop certainly did not work out. Luis Avilan did not work out. None of them worked out, but at least they were buyers. The Phillies were buyers at the trade deadline. They tried. I think they did most of what we had hoped they would do. They didn't get starting pitching, but they were able to go ahead and actually be active. It was great to see them go to not all in. They didn't go all in, but they went in and became buyers, which I like to see. Number four, watching the scoreboard in August and early September. It was great to be scoreboard watching again at an important part in the season. It was a lot of fun to be checking the scoreboard, checking the standings every morning. What did Atlanta do? What did Washington do? To see Washington falter this year was really awesome. Unfortunately, as I'm going to get to in just a minute, watching the scoreboard became painful towards the end of the season. But my fifth favorite thing from the 2018 Philly season was Sir Anthony Dominguez, who I think should go into next year as the team's closer. I want him to be the guy who either pitches the eighth inning or the ninth inning, but to be the guy to get those final three outs. I've come around on this. I don't agree that you should wait to use your closer in a tie game on the road. I think you use Sir Anthony Dominguez in the highest leverage spots, but I also think that means you got to get another reliever in here if you're going to do that. You need to have a few reliable options at the back of the bullpen. No more freaking Tommy Hunter. No more damn Tommy Hunter in the back of the bullpen. Pitching in key spots. okay? No more. No more. Enough with Tommy Hunter. And Pat Nashak's okay in the back of the bullpen, too. But I watching Sir Anthony Dominguez, I'm excited to see what an offseason of training as a relief pitcher, coming into the season, knowing what his role is going to be, hopefully knowing what his role is going to be, will just be a big boon for him. I think it could go, I think it do wonders because he's got amazing stuff. He could be an elite closer in this league. This stuff is there. So that's what I'm hoping to see. That was one of my five favorite things from the 2018 season. My five least favorite things. Obviously, all of the controversy surrounding Gabe Kapler. Well, you know, he obviously has his detractors. He obviously also has his benefactors. I think both camps swing wildly too far in each direction. Gabe Kapler was good enough to come on this podcast, which is great. I mean, he's personable. He reaches out. He understands the value of communication. He accepts constructive criticism. I hope the criticism that has been aired on this podcast has been constructive. I've tried never to take cheap shots. I will never call for Gabe Kapler to be fired because I don't call for anyone to be fired because I think that's lowbrow. That's not what I do here. But I will call out bad decisions. I will call out things that I'm frustrated about. Things that he has said that I think are silly or not productive or detrimental in some way. You know, that's my job. You know, that's what I'm supposed to do here. But I want Gabe Kapler to succeed. I'm also not going to sugarcoat everything. I'm not going to buy everything hook, line, and sinker that he's trying to do if it doesn't make sense to me. I will always be looking forward to him to explain things and try and find the rationale in what he's doing, but the wild swings one way or the other that Gabe Kapler is an idiot and he's stupid and all this analytics stuff is garbage. The hatred of the analytics is one of the other things. I'm gonna lump it all into the same thing. That was one of my least favorite things about 2018. And the other side of it, the Gabe Kapler can do no wrong crew, I'm done with. Enough of that. Let's look at the man and what he's doing objectively. Results on the field will determine in a lot of ways, a lot of times, not all the time, because sometimes the results don't match the process, but what we saw from Gabe Kapler this year was a very uneven season. And I think that's important to note. And the wild fluctuations back and forth, it was one of my least favorite things of the 2018 season. The defense and the lack of fundamentals was one of the other things I hated about the 2018 season. Completely uncalled for. Completely unacceptable. How this team could be so completely and unbelievably unaware of the fundamentals so often was exhausting to me. Number four, the inability to beat the damn Mets. The Phillies' inability to eat the Mets this year just ate at me. And really, the Mets came close to finishing with a better record than the Phillies. Enough with the Mets. The Phillies have to figure out a way to beat this team. They've been unable to beat this team over the last 2 years, and it's been driving me freaking crazy. So they've got to figure out a way to beat the Mets. And then, of course, my least favorite thing about the team was the utter collapse during the last 6 or 7 weeks of the season. And we've gone over it ad nauseum. I'm not going to go over it again, but obviously that was a horrible coda on the 2018 season and did not leave Phillies fans with a good feeling, with a good taste in their mouth following that season, mine included. And so those are my five least favorite things about the 2018 Philly season and my five favorite things about how 2018 went for your fightin' Phils.
This ball is out of here!
And now it's time for your stat of the week. And this came from Scott Lauber's excellent newsletter that he does with Philly.com, where they, you know, during the season, every day they put out a newsletter. It's very good, full of really good information. And this was noted on it this week. Saturday marks the 10-year anniversary of one of the most memorable home runs in Philly's history. On October 13th, 2008, Matt Stairs hit that pinch-hit two-run homer off Jonathan Broxton in Game 4 of the NLCS to give the Phillies a 7-5 win. There have been only 27 pinch-hit home runs in league championship series since the playoffs were expanded in 1969, and there haven't been any since Andre Ethier, when he was with the Dodgers, and Miguel Montero with the Cubs went deep in Game 1 of the National League Championship Series on October 15th, 2016. And folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Scott Lauber for coming on the podcast once again. And a reminder, folks, if you want a preview of the National League and American League Championship Series, go over to patreon.com/hittin'season. I will have those up on Friday morning. Also, make sure you're subscribing to the Good Fight podcast feed. That way you get Hittin' Season, continued success, and the Dirty Inning every time a new podcast is up and ready to go. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.
Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, on the Liberty Ballers Podcast Network for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to the Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.